podcast, home to stories that haunt. These stories may contain graphic depictions of violence or explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Everything doesn't have to be such a thing, Sam said, and shoved another box onto the pile she'd been constructing all morning. You're my sister, and I love you more than anything, but everything doesn't have to have meaning, you know? Some things are just boring, normal things unbound by the threads of fate, or whatever.
But these were our dad's things.
I totally get it,
Sam softened her tone, remembering where we were and what we were doing.
But I promise you, he didn't mean to leave that upside down.
She pointed at a painting of a woman that we'd found hanging upside down over his bed.
He was just gone at the end. Nothing going on upstairs, you know?
She stepped over the heap of clothes between us to squeeze me and remind me that she was always on my side. I sighed and conceded.
I know you're right. I need to stop looking for miracles around every corner. But if there's a time to look for meaning in your life, it's definitely after your dad dies, especially after everything.
Couldn't agree more, Sam nodded. But if all of the shit Dad owned has to be designated a precious artifact, it will be 20 years before we get the house on the market.
I laughed and nodded in return.
I just wish things had been different.
I put the painting and the pile of things to donate, and pulled open a dusty tub full of random paperwork from the late 1970s.
Me too.
Sam's voice tightened and she turned away. Sam had been even closer to our father than I had when we were young, and the changes had been the hardest on her. Her emotional armour was almost impenetrable by the time Dad died, but I caught glimpses of real pain behind the golden flecks and the green eyes she shared with our mother. Our mum had left one night when I was just 7, so I didn't have any real memories of her in the physical form. But I had studied the few photos of her until the edges had frayed into a soft, cottony frame around her handsome face. That's how people always referred to her, handsome. She was a handsome woman with her sloping cheekbones, strong nose, and wide, almost phosphorant eyes. She and Sam had that in common too. Sam had a powerful face and presence, like a model from a World War II poster. She was a woman who could hold a country together while the men were away. I fell more on the homely side of the spectrum and would be better suited for soft tasks like passing library books across counters or answering questions in regional museums. But I didn't mind. I was safe with Sam, protected. And people assumed greatness in me based on my proximity to her, and so I kept her close always. It feels cliché to be the child of a woman who went out for a pack of smokes or carton of milk and never returned, but that's exactly what happened. She'd simply risen from her seat on our brown leather sofa, mumbled that she would be right back, and disappeared forever. Our father had been too distracted by the program they'd been watching to dig for any additional information, so had lost his stunning wife to a mysterious new life and was left to raise Sam and I alone.
I'm going to have an asthma attack if I don't take a break,
Sam announced with an exaggerated swipe at the hairs that had come loose from her bun.
Go get some air,
I encouraged.
I'll finish this bit and then meet you on the porch for some coffee. Amazing.
The stack of books she was holding landed at her feet with a loud smack, and she dusted off her flannel and jeans the best she could with her equally dusty hands.
I'll whip up a snack with whatever expired food I can find in the pantry.
Perfect, I laughed.
I would kill for a can of blackberry pie filling from the mid-90s. Pairs perfectly with the 6 half-eaten boxes of stale digestives,
Sam joked back and disappeared through the bedroom door. I took a moment to assess the area around me on the floor and was pleasantly surprised at how much progress we'd made that morning. The corner of a thin cardboard box that was sticking out from underneath the bed caught my eye, so I tugged on it. But it was heavier than I'd anticipated. I repositioned myself to get a better grip and pulled out a large stack of something wrapped in several sheets that I recognized from my childhood. 100 Snoopies were eating 100 hamburgers on the sheet on top, and I pulled it back to reveal a heavy-looking wooden framed mirror underneath. I set the mirror aside, peeled off the flower pattern sheet below it, and found another, smaller mirror that I remembered hung in our entryway as a kid.
"Really, Dad?"
My voice sounded more sad than annoyed as I uncovered several more mirrors in the stack, and I wondered how I hadn't noticed they'd been missing from the walls of the house. We'd only arrived the night before, and it had been close to 20 years since I'd stepped inside the massive wood-panelled home, but I still felt a little foolish for not noticing that all of the mirrors in the house were missing from the spots that they'd hung throughout my childhood.
"We've officially reached cliché crazy dad status."
Sam was rocking gently on the enormous front porch, and I cradled the hot mug in my hands for extra warmth in the cool spring air as I slid into the chair beside her.
"Oh yeah?"
She held out a plate of cheese and olives that she salvaged from the kitchen, and I popped some in my mouth before continuing.
"Yeah, at least half the mirrors from the house are stacked under his bed. I imagine the rest are piled under one of the guest beds because there aren't any hanging in the house anymore."
Sam let out an exasperated huff of a laugh and shook her head.
"God, he was such a drama queen."
"Right." I reached for another expensive-tasting green olive and we sat in silence for a moment. Our father hadn't held a candle to our mother when it came to looks, but his exceptional mind and creative flair had more than made up for his average face. His enormous bank account hadn't hurt either. His parents' money had left him free to explore his every whim, and he'd become an expert on many subjects over the years. I wouldn't have been able to list them all if you'd put a gun to my head. He'd kept Sam and I up past our bedtime on more occasions than I could count so we could watch some science program together on public television, or so we could listen to his conversations with whatever brilliant person he and our mum had invited over for dinner and drinks. But that was all before Mum disappeared, of course. And before the day he stopped talking and never started again, despite the doctor's insistence that he would.
"Like, fine, Dad. Hole up in this house and isolate yourself from everyone and everything, but taking down the mirrors?"
"It was all the time he spent with that Italian film director."
Sam looked at me slyly out of the corner of her eye, knowing she'd spur a deep buried memory of the man with our favourite childhood name.
"Alfredo Potato!"
She cracked a rare smile as I shouted his name, remembering. His last name had actually been Potrillo or something similar, but our young ears had heard it as Potato, which had been endlessly amusing to us.
"God, he was such a douche."
"Douche indeed," she agreed, and we stumbled over each other to share memories of the creepy, pretentious stories he told in his cartoonish accent.
"Dad was friends with some real winners,"
Sam said, and I wiped tears away from my eyes, laughing so hard at the time he'd claimed he'd seen Strom Thurmond at his sex party.
"6,
I interjected as my laugh sputtered, then stalled out completely as the dark of our family dysfunction returned to settle over us.
"Should we get back to it?"
Sam offered and stood up. The cool country air was clarifying, so I nodded and breathed in as much as I could before following her back to the complicated confines of our childhood home.
"Some of this stuff is worth something, you know,"
Sam said once we were back inside.
"I've been thinking the same thing."
I ran a hand over the Scandinavian credenza in the entryway that I'd seen trending on interior design sites for years. There were two water rings on one corner where some drunken guest had set their drink and dropped the value considerably, but I was sure we could still get a couple of £100 from someone willing to refinish it.
"I have a friend who has an estate sale business. Maybe I should send him some photos and see if there's interest,"
Sam suggested, and I nodded in agreement.
"I could use a break from the bedroom, so I'll take some photos and measurements of a few things," I offered.
"That sounds great."
Sam smiled weakly and disappeared to finish sorting the contents of our father's bedroom. I was so young when it happened, but I was pretty sure it'd taken around 5 or 6 months for Dad to stop talking to us after our mum left. At first, he acted like nothing had happened, like our mother was just on vacation, but things would go back to normal eventually. And there was no reason to be concerned, despite not hearing from her at all, or the fact that she'd left literally everything she'd owned, including her purse, identification, and her car behind. Sam had been the one to finally tell me she wasn't coming back. She was 11 and I was 8, and she had the heightened awareness of an eldest daughter, so I think she had known for a while before she finally broke the news to me.
"Mum's not coming back," she said so matter-of-factly one day after school, it had taken my breath away.
I had been blabbering on about my plans for an upcoming birthday and how I was going to ask our mother to make cupcakes instead of cake that year, and she dropped the news of the abandonment like she'd been tossing the day's mail out onto the countertop. I knew better than to argue with my older, wiser sister, and so held the hurt inside and spent my days on high alert looking for signs that she was right, which of course she had been. And it was me who had finally broken our father one afternoon as we ambled down the road in the vintage pickup truck that I'd hated at the time, but would have killed to get my hands on as I'd gotten older. He had been blabbering on about some future plans that had included our mother, and I had auditioned my best Sam impersonation, attempting her unwavering tone as I informed my 43-year-old father that his wife was never coming home. As the words still hung in the stale air between us, he blinked repeatedly, then cleared his throat an equal number of times, and then never spoke another word. Not one. The doctors said it was temporary, that it was just his way of processing his grief, and reassured us that he would speak again once his brain let him know that he was safe. But I guess he never felt safe again because he never uttered a single word moving forward. He'd communicate through nods and the notes he left for us around the house, but Sam was smart and I was strong, so we quickly adapted to needing him less and less, and so the silence didn't affect us as much as you'd think it would have. Not to mention that Sam had always served as a stand-in parent to me when ours were off being their eccentric selves, so it was an easy transition for us to fall into the roles more permanently. At first, Dad made sure to leave small amounts of money for us at the beginning of each week for lunches and outings with friends. And he continued to cook our meals for us so we could gather round the dinner table for strange, silent meals together. As time went on, he'd leave larger stacks of money and cooked less and less so he could retreat to the upper floors of the house to do God knows what. The sums of money got larger and larger until he was leaving stacks so thick we'd lost count once we'd got into the thousands. Sam had the foresight to start a savings account for us, and when she moved out of the house at 18, she brought me with her. We returned for holidays and birthdays for a couple of years, but our dad's silence grew louder, his moods more menacing, and by the time I was 18, we were both so busy with our own lives, we visited less and less until we didn't visit at all. The last time we'd come, it had been to bring him lunch and a cake for his 60th birthday, and we'd both had to prepare for several days to get up the nerve to make the trip. He had been on his best behaviour when we'd arrived. His eyes lit up slightly at the sight of cake, and he'd been able to make eye contact for more than he had for years. But midway through the meal, he'd stood up from the table and disappeared to the upstairs bathroom while Sam and I exchanged looks across the table. When he hadn't returned after 40 minutes, I suggested we should check on him, but Sam protested, saying it was just Dad being Dad and we should leave him be. "But it's his birthday," I argued weakly, and allowed the pang of guilt that we'd basically abandoned our father to lead me upstairs to see if he was okay. I knocked softly and called his name, then listened on the other side of the door for a while when he didn't answer. Eventually, I heard the shattering of something small and glass, so cracked open the door and called his name again before tentatively stepping into the short hall that led to a dressing area, and then through to the huge bathroom on the other side. I could hear him retching as I approached, and it wasn't a sound I'd ever heard him or any other human make before. He sounded less like he was trying to expel something and more like he was transforming or mutating. As he came into view in the bathroom, the retching turned into wailing, and I watched from the shadows of the dressing room as he screamed and contorted his thin, now naked body across the cold marble floor. His clothes were wadded in the toilet that threatened to overflow on the other side of the room, and the sound of his thin skin stretching across the marble as he arched back and kicked his legs into impossible positions made me want to retch as well. I knew I should have rushed to help him or call for help before I fled, but the wailing was too much, too overwhelming and terrifying, and I felt the first pangs of rage towards him for retreating inside himself after our mother left, instead of stepping up and caring for the young girls who needed him. I had kept the anger buried for the most part, chose instead to focus on my love and pity for our solitary father, but it stirred as I watched him writhe, and I was afraid of what would happen if I allowed it to come to the surface. And so I turned instead, walked back downstairs, and announced to Sam that it was time to leave.
"Everything okay?" she asked in the tone that said she already knew that things were not okay and would never be okay when it came to our father.
"That's just sick." I shrugged and started to clear the plates from the table. Sam followed my lead and wrapped up the remaining cake in cellophane to preserve on the off chance our father decided to enjoy it later. Once the party had been packed up and the house returned to its majestic but depressing state, my sister and I walked silently to our cars and drove away from what remained of our family forever. Being back in the house was horrible, but also somehow comforting. Sam and I had been able to convince the world that we were more or less normal people with normal upbringings, but I don't think we'd ever been able to fully shake the feeling of being on the outside. And so there was something almost empowering about being in the place that knew us best. The place that embraced our outsider status and shielded us from the constant reminders that we were different, weird, unwanted. I decided to start by photographing the custom dining set that my mother had traded piano lessons for, despite the fact that they had more than enough money to pay for it outright. They liked to cosplay that they were normal, folksy people to gain entry to the artists and artisans in the area, and the house was full of art and woodwork that they'd collected as a result. My plan was to photograph each piece separately and then as a whole, but when I reached for the nearest chair to pull it back, it wouldn't move an inch. The momentum of attempting to move something unmovable caused me to wheel back slightly, and I corrected so that I could lean forward to see what was blocking the chair. I'd expected to find a heavy moving box wedged in between the legs, but instead found 10 or 15 thick nails that had been driven through the sides of the chair legs and into the wooden floor below. The legs of the table and other chairs had also been pinned to the ground with so many bent, rusting nails that they wouldn't budge, even when I pulled as hard as I could. I crossed to the buffet that stretched along the opposite wall, and it had also been tracked permanently into place. And so had the china cabinet, the small table by the kitchen door, and the plant stand in the corner. I hurried into the living room to inspect the furniture and found that every single piece had been permanently secured in there too, and in the entryway, the kitchen and the guest room. I burst into our father's room. "Dad nailed all of the furniture to the ground," I announced breathlessly, and Sam raised her head slowly, forever unfazed.
"He did what?"
She set down her things in her hand and leaned back against the bed so she could see me better.
"I was trying to pull out the chair in the dining room and it wouldn't move. I don't know how I didn't notice sooner, but Dad nailed down every single piece of furniture in the house. See?"
I whipped back the corner of the quilt closest to my sister to reveal the collection of nails jutting out of the leg of the bed frame.
"Why would he do that?"
Sam wondered aloud. I shrugged. "Maybe he started losing his balance before he died."
"Dad was 140 pounds soaking wet," my sister argued. "He could barely budge a piece of furniture on his best day."
"Well, I have no idea," I conceded as I scanned the furniture in the room.
"It's weird though, yeah?"
"It's Dad."
Sam resumed packing the pile of stuff in front of her, and I stood for a moment, wanting to continue the conversation but realizing there wasn't anything more to say. Sam was right. It was weird, but our dad was the weirdest, and so speculating about some new strange thing he'd done was a total waste of our time and energy. Good point. I conceded for the second time and flipped on the radio on the dresser next to me to find some music to keep us company while we continued to dismantle our dead dad's strange, sad life. I found the letters 3 hours later. I decided to tackle Dad's office, but it only took an hour for me to decide we'd be better off just taking a match to all of it, because rather than finding paperwork outlining secret valuable investments, it was just an endless hoard of faded art magazines and loose receipts from antique dealers. I'd graduated to just glancing at each document before I jammed it into the growing pile of thick black garbage bags that were filling up the area near the door, and was just about to add a brittle yellow envelope when I glimpsed something that froze my hand mid-reach. In the half of the millisecond that it had taken to pass my face, I'd seen my own name in the faded ink of the typewriter Dad had insisted on using long after home computers had become available. I retracted the envelope and read the address below my name. It was the address I'd shared with Sam in the years after she'd rescued me from the dysfunction of our home. The words, "Return to sender," had been scrawled across the address when I flipped it over. It was still sealed shut. The seam at the top flaked away easily as I worked my pointer finger underneath and pulled out 3 sheets of paper that had been pulled from a spiral notebook. The sentence, "She will take your mind," was handwritten neatly over and over on every line of the front and back of each page. There was no greeting or signature, nothing but the awful words on repeat. I flipped the envelope over again to confirm what I'd seen, and it was my name and previous address that were typed on the front. I dug into the drawer where I'd found the letter and pulled out a stack of identical envelopes, all addressed to me, all returned to my father, and the contents of every single envelope were just pages of the same type of paper full of the same sentence. I didn't realise I was crying until a tear plopped onto the paper in my hand and the sound of the impact made me jump in the enormous quiet of the room. I wiped my cheeks with the back of my sleeves and shoved the pages in their envelopes. I slid one into the interior pocket of my jacket, a sick souvenir of my father's mental illness, and went to the dining room table to see if he had anything alcoholic stashed in the group of old cabinets that he'd nailed to the floor. Sam clearly had the same thought because I found her slumped in a dusty overstuffed chair with an equally dusty bottle of very expensive-looking scotch on the coffee table in front of her. She nodded to the chair next to her and I collapsed into it gratefully while she poured me a generous portion. I'd never liked scotch, but I tapped my glass against hers and then slugged back a quarter of the drink in one gulp. She topped it off before crumpling back into her chair. "This is quite a lot," I breathed through the burn of the alcohol. "Yeah, it's pretty fucked," she agreed. "What did you find?" I asked and forced myself to set the drink down so I wouldn't finish it too quickly. "Did you know he could paint?" I shook my head and reached for the glass, deciding that drinking it too quickly was a good idea after all. "He painted the same woman over and over." Sam ran a hand over her face before continuing. "Like, maybe 100 times? I stopped counting at 35.
"What woman?"
"No idea." She shrugged and then shivered. "I'm pretty sure it was the same woman that was hanging over his bed. He only painted her from behind, kind of looked like Mum's hair, but taller, way taller and very broad." Sam held out her hands to indicate the woman's shoulders had been wider than hers.
"Maybe Omar?" I offered.
Our father's mother had been a very large and intimidating woman, so much so that Sam and I had nicknamed her the Trunchbull after the sadistic principal in the book Matilda. I had inherited our German grandmother's build and had towered over the rest of the family by the time I hit puberty.
"Maybe," Sam agreed and shook her head to clear her thoughts. "Whoever it is, it's bloody weird."
"Well, I found a stack of letters that he tried to send to me that just said, 'She will take your mind,' over and over again." Sam's eyes widened and filled with tears. From sadness or fear, I couldn't tell which, but I didn't have time to ask because she shot the last of her scotch and stood up.
"I'm going to bed,"
she announced, and placed the cap on her booze.
What?
I protested, then looked at my watch.
10:30. How is that possible?
Time flies when you're examining the contents of your father's batshit crazy life.
Sam joked, and I couldn't help but crack a smile.
Early bird gets the ice pick to the brain. You know, because crazy people need lobotomies.
I know. Sam shouted through her laughter.
The joke isn't funny if you have to explain it. God, you're the worst.
She awkwardly pulled me out of the chair and into a hug.
You're the worst.
I mumbled into her hair before she lovingly pushed me away.
Good night, kid.
Good night, Sam.
I said to her back as it receded up into the darkness of the stairs. The glass and a half of scotch on an empty stomach suddenly caught up to me as I watched her go, and I eased myself onto the couch so I could get my bearings before heading off to bed myself. I laid back and studied the clusters of photos on the walls. I'd spent my entire childhood with all of it, but hadn't ever really looked at any of it until that moment. The black and white faces of ancestors I couldn't name stared down at me, disappointed in the daughter who'd left their son to collapse under his own mind in the impressive estate they'd all worked so hard to give him.
I hate you,
I whispered back at them.
I hate him and I hate you.
I closed my eyes to their judgment and the ghosts of that horrible house and my horrible childhood. I heard a gentle rustling in the corner of the room, like fabric brushing against wood or old, rough hands smoothing something soft. I wondered if it was just the sound of my blood churning around my skull as my body sent it to protect my brain from the alcohol, but there was something comforting about it either way. I imagined our mother mending a tear in one of our dresses, our grandmother smoothing imaginary wrinkles in her always immaculate clothes, or the wife of one of my father's friends teaching me to fold paper into animal shapes at one of their parties. I wanted it to be a nice sound, a comforting sound. But behind the safety of my fantasies, there was something evil stirring. Something I couldn't see but was remembering had become my constant companion throughout my childhood. Something starving and relentless with empty eyes or no eyes at all. It was the thing we had run from, and I thought we'd lost it. But maybe had been the one hiding. Had we been hiding together? The sound grew louder than my conscious thoughts, and I knew if I stayed, she'd reveal herself, and I didn't want to remember. I didn't want to see her. So I allowed myself to get lost in the rhythm and be carried into a deep, fretful sleep. I woke up suddenly to a clattering in one of the rooms above me and shot straight up, wincing against the headache that had formed from not enough water and too much brown alcohol. I heard another clatter and then a rolling sound, so headed upstairs to investigate. But when I got to the first landing, I could see a light on under the door to the small room built into the slope of the attic stairs. We called the room the Chokey growing up. Another reference to the torture Matilda and her peers endured in the beloved children's book. Our mum claimed that it had been a disappointments room, a place where families put their ill or disabled children to hide them from the world. She'd joke that she'd lock us in there if we didn't behave, which had terrified me until one of our more reasonable aunts had explained that it had just been a storage room for the servants' supplies back when the house had still required them. I couldn't help but hold my breath as the fears of the past prickled under my skin and I crept up the stairs towards the Chokey. I felt so small despite being nearly 6 feet tall, and the feeling of a thousand eyes watching from below pressed against me until I had to glance back to be sure I was alone on the stairs. I tentatively pushed the door open to the room once I'd reached the top, and Sam gasped in fear as the hinges creaked and the light poured over my silhouette in the doorway.
Jesus, you scared me,
she scolded as I crossed the threshold.
You scared me,
I shot back and glanced down at my watch.
It's 2 a.m.
She softened and patted the spot next to her on the wooden floor.
I couldn't sleep, so I started looking for these.
The dim light glinted off of something in her hand and she turned towards me so I could get a better look. I drew in my breath.
Mum's dolls.
Hunched over so that I could fit under the slanted ceiling of the room, I claimed the seat next to her as the memory of our mother's beloved two-faced dolls came crashing back.
I can't believe I'd forgotten about these.
Sam stroked the head of the one she was holding. When we were small, our mother would occasionally bring out three gorgeous antique dolls that were among her most precious possessions. They all had intricately painted faces and elaborate gowns that had been painstakingly sewn by someone decades before we were born. The doll in Sam's lap was breathtaking. Even more so as an adult who understands how much work had gone into crafting her sparkling eyes and the beading in the layers of her skirts. Sam handed it to me and I traced my finger over the impossible detail on the bodice of her dress and the delicate bow of her lips. My sister reached across and gently turned the doll to reveal the other side, and I let out a yelp of fear as the doll's second face, the other face I'd somehow forgotten, snarled up at me ferociously. Her dress was the same on both sides, but her second face was as grotesque as her first was beautiful, and I couldn't imagine how someone had managed to convey so much malice with just paint on porcelain. Her eyes were black, with just the tiniest speck of white in the middle that looked lost in a dark corridor of terror. Her teeth were bared and bloody, her nose a slanted, lizard-like slit.
How could I have forgotten about these?
I looked at Sam through the tears that were welling in my eyes. She shook her head and took out the second doll and then the third, each somehow more beautiful and horrifying than the other.
Where did she get these?
I pleaded, finding it impossible to imagine who had made them or how our sweet mother had gotten them. Sam shook her head again and said softly,
"Remember that this one is you?"
She held up the second doll she pulled from the box.
"Do you remember which one was me?"
I studied the other two until the embroidered deer on the hem of the third doll's dress sparked the memory.
"That one! The fawn doll!"
I exclaimed and blushed as my voice verged on the babyish tone I'd worked so hard to abandon so I could be as strong and sophisticated as my sister and mother. Sam's middle name was Fawn and had been the name that our father had called her exclusively, so anything with a deer on it was automatically hers as we were growing up. She smiled, touched the deer on the skirt, then reached for the doll that we had pretended was me when Mum would allow us to see them. She pulled back the top layer of the doll's ruffles to expose the vibrant polka dot fabric hidden as a surprise on the other side.
Dot. That was my middle name.
Our father's mother's name was Dorothy, and so they shortened it and slid it between my first and last names like an out-of-place punctuation mark. Sam had been named something lithe and graceful, something precious and protected like her. When I was born, they had drawn a tight circle on the place where my middle name should have been, and had trusted that if it widened into a hole and I fell over the edge, I'd eventually hit bottom. I'd been falling ever since.
"The dot doll,"
Sam said, smiling softly, and the words triggered a memory so strong my body jerked with the force of it.
"Hey!"
my sister protested as I pushed off of her shoulder to stand up and clambered to the back of the small room. I heard the crack of my doll's face as it rolled off my lap and hit the hard floor below. I hoped for a second that the monster side of the doll had been damaged and not the beautiful one, but shoved the thought aside as I ran my hands over the back wall in front of me until I found the points I was looking for. I laid my palms flat against the panel and pushed it until I heard the click of the latches opening and the entire wall swung towards me. I could hear Sam suck in her breath as I stepped through and into the larger hidden room on the other side. I'd realised later in life that it was probably a panic room and had been built to hide the wealthy inhabitants of the home in the event of a robbery or uprising. But as a child, it had just been my favourite place to spend time alone. The room was just as lovely as the rest of the rooms in the house and had several comfortable places to sit or lie down in case someone needed to hide for several hours or days. And so it had been the perfect place for a young girl to daydream and lose track of time. Something shattered under my foot as I stepped to turn the light on, and I felt a sharp stab through my sock into my flesh.
Shit!
I steadied myself in the doorway so I could remove the shard of broken porcelain lodged in my foot. Sam pushed past me and aimed the light on her phone towards the thing I'd stepped on. She gasped again as it illuminated the innocent faces of hundreds of tiny ceramic deer on the floor in front of us.
My menagerie.
She breathed and stepped into the room, careful not to crush any of the others. In the years before Mum left, Sam and our father had collected every deer figurine they'd come across to fill the shelves and surfaces of her room. Dad called it her menagerie, which had filled me with an aching jealousy to have a menagerie of my own, but I had never been old enough or gentle enough to have something so delicate and precious. I watched as Sam studied the tiny figures assembled on the floor, and the wonder on her face turned to confusion and then fear. She pressed her hand over her mouth and took a step back as I turned to see what was scaring her. The deer were all facing the door and had been meticulously laid out in single-file lines that stretched and curved round to form three letters. R-U-N. I turned back to Sam, prepared to make another joke about our father's state of mind, but the look on her face cut the words short before they could leave my throat.
He was trying to warn me.
She cast her eyes towards the floor and shook her head gently as she tried to make sense of the word on the floor.
Warn you of what?
I watched my sister fight to find her usual strength as several silent seconds stretched out between us. When she finally raised her eyes to meet mine, she looked more self-assured, but hints of fear were still tangled in the gold and green.
Of you.
Her voice was a half whisper. I shook my head and reached out as I took a step towards her, desperate to salvage whatever was unwinding between us. She flinched and pressed her back against the wall behind her.
Oh, come on, Sam. This is just another one of Dad's things. Well, why on earth would you think it was some kind of warning?
A tear spilled out of the edge of one of her eyes and then the other. She let them fall as she cleared her throat to continue.
Because he's been trying to warn me for years. But I refuse to believe him. Warn you of what?
My voice was higher and more hysterical than I'd intended, so I lowered it and softened my stance before repeating.
Of what?
As gently as I could.
Of you,
she said again and swiped at her tears.
Of what you do to people.
Sam's eyes were cold then, full of the ice I'd seen in them for other people. People who meant her harm or ill will, but never for me. It was crushing to look to the person I loved the most, depended on the most, and not receive a single shred of love or comfort in return.
Sam, what?
I trailed off, so confused as to what was happening or what she was saying.
What are you talking about? He'd been telling me that you were dangerous for years. Even before Mum left, he knew. He'd tell me to be careful. He'd never let us play alone. He was afraid of what you'd do to me.
Jesus, Sam. You sound just like him. What did he say exactly?
He'd say things like, she's going to take me too, or she'll never stop, she's never satisfied. And after Mum left, he said it was because of you, and that you turned on him after she was gone. He'd tell me everything you did, the ways you burrowed into his head. He claimed you'd whisper horrible things in his ear at night, and eventually all day too. He said that every time he turned around, you were there showing him awful, nightmarish things, and that you'd started doing terrible things to him and he couldn't control you. And once he stopped talking, he passed me notes that said that you'd been the one who'd stolen his voice too.
He said it was me? That I was doing those things to him? I was so upset I could barely catch my breath enough to ask the question.
He'd say, she's doing things to me, she's trying to hurt me, she's going to kill me, and you were the only one here, so it had to be you.
Sam, for fuck's sake, you know me. And Dad was insane, like certifiably insane. He could have been talking about anyone.
She shook her head so violently it scared me into silence again.
That's what I thought too. That's why I took you out of here as soon as I could, because I thought Dad was the crazy one and I wanted to protect us from him. But since we've been back here...
Her voice caught in her throat with a sharp, painful-sounding hitch, and she cleared it aggressively so she could finish.
Since we've been back here, now that Dad's gone, I feel it too. I feel it everywhere.
Sam, I would never hurt you. What are you talking about?
And to find this in here...
Sam waved a hand over the deer on the floor and her eyes clouded with memory for a moment before clearing. She looked up and locked eyes with me.
Everything changed after my birthday. When that awful Susan Preston trapped you in here all morning.
I thought back but didn't have a clue what she was referring to. I could remember our snotty neighbour Susan and had vague memories of our mother forcing us to spend time with her on birthdays or dinner parties, but couldn't remember her doing anything bad to me.
In here? What are you talking about?
Susan Preston tricked you into coming up here during my 8th birthday party, and no one realised you were missing until everyone was leaving. When they finally found you, 3 hours had passed, and you'd been up here, stuck in this dark room the whole time. You were only 5, and you were so different when you came out. Mum and Dad said you were just scared and would get back to normal the next day, but you never did.
What? No, I loved this room as a kid. I spent hours in here, alone.
Sam shook her head.
No, you didn't. You never came up here again. Never. I spent hours in here. It was the only place I could go that I knew you wouldn't follow me, so I'd hide up here when I needed a break, especially after Mum left. This was my special place, and that's how Dad knew that I'd find this if he left it in here.
We both turned to study the message on the floor, hoping for clarity on the situation, but rows of tiny eyes just stared back, unblinking.
I think Dad was telling me to run from you,
I decided aloud, and looked up at my sister, a small fire sparking in my chest in the hope that I might be right.
He's telling me to run from Fawn. You are Fawn, so this message is from me. No, this message is for me because I am Fawn.
Sam's eyes held the same fire I felt growing inside.
But he sent me the letters,
I shouted, remembering the letter I'd stashed in my jacket pocket. I pulled it out and thrust it towards her, proof that Dad had been trying to warn me of something and not her. Sam took the brittle pages and studied them for a moment before looking up. The fire in her eyes grew and a satisfied smirk crossed her lips. It was the smile only an older sister can smile, the self-assured I told you so that is the kryptonite of all younger siblings.
This is your handwriting,
she said slowly, allowing time for me to comprehend what she was saying. She passed one of the pages back and I snatched it from her, desperate to prove her wrong. But when I looked back at the page, a sick, sinking feeling replaced the confidence I'd held moments before. She was right. It was my hand that had written the words, "She will take your mind," over and over until they lost their meaning between the lines of the page. I had no memory of writing it. Not the slightest spark of recollection, nor did I have any idea who or what I'd been referring to when I had. I thought so hard, I was afraid I'd burst a blood vessel, but I couldn't remember any of the things Sam said had happened to me. The harder I tried, the more I realised I couldn't really remember any of my childhood at all. There were hazy recollections, feelings of moments and events, and flashes of faces, but nothing lined up chronologically to tell the story of my life. I could remember the house and our family. I could remember the room we were standing in and the hours and hours that I'd spent in there, but I had no idea what I did during those hours. I remembered our parents' parties, the sound of the piano, the safety I found in Sam. I could picture the faint outline of my mother's smile and hear the echoes of the people who had walked the long halls between rooms, the soft swishing of fabric against wood and rough skin.
I heard it then, splitting through time and space, interrupting our natural bond. Our mother had loved us, our fathers had loved him, and her mother had loved her, but something had got in the way of it all. Something had haunted our lineage, and it was rocking the corner of the room, swaying in the rhythm of the time it had shattered, stretched and forever threatening to take us, to take the men and women, to take our minds and turn them. He must have sent them to warn me because I wrote this about you. My own shouting broke me out of the spell, and I was filled with a new resolve to prove my sister wrong and put our lives back on course. And you returned them before I could open them and remember that I was in danger. I think he was trying to make you remember, Sam said sadly. I think he hoped that if you saw what you'd written, maybe it would break the spell, and whatever had happened to you, whatever happened in this room, would lose its hold and we'd all be safe again. Nothing happened in this room! I was screaming. My broad shoulders ached to swing free and destroy my sister's words. I wanted to rip the house down and bury us inside it. I craved an end to the torture of knowing that something was always wrong, but never meeting our monster. The sound persisted in the corner, sinister and restrained. I wanted to ask Sam if she could hear it too, but I knew she could. Or maybe she had her own sound, something low and consuming, shifting in her shadows and dark corners. You just have to remember. Just remember, and maybe you'll be free. We'll be free, Sam pleaded. I studied her tears as they gleamed in the wedge of light from the other room. You have to remember too. I realized too late that the light in Sam's tears was shifting, growing dim, and then it was gone. All of the light in the room disappeared as the door swung closed and sealed shut behind us. A metallic clang echoed through the darkness, and I realized then, the moment it was too late, that it was the sound of the safety lock our parents had installed after Sam's party to seal it off completely. The massive bolt that had prevented us from ever entering the room again and had contained all of the danger and all of my fear forever. They had kept us safe, right? Or maybe I'd never left. I reached for Sam in the dark. There was only air. I wanted to call her name, but I knew it would be drowned out by the sound that had moved out of the corner and was everywhere all around me. The sound of the hands of the eyeless woman sliding so slowly across the floor in the darkness toward me to climb inside of me. Or was it the sound of the blood of a 5-year-old girl crushing around in her own skull to drown out the terror, swirling around her brain while her life and future play out on an infinite loop as she waits for someone to find her?
By Missley Rose Neville. Our Patreon is officially live, so for more stories that haunt, as well as a behind-the-scenes look at what we do and why we do it, please join at patreon.com/pleaseleavepod. You can follow Please Leave on Facebook and Instagram at Please Leave Pod. Our email is pleaseleavepod@gmail.com, and our website is pleaseleavepod.com.